Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Dr. Eduardo Fernandez. Dr. Fernandez received his PhD in psychology, minors in neuroscience and animal behavior from Indiana University, where he worked with the Indianapolis and Cincinnati Zoo. He received his MS in behavior analysis from the University of North Texas, where he founded and was president of the Organization for Reinforcement Contingency with Animals, otherwise known as ORCA. Most of his past and current work involves conducting research on the behavioral welfare of captive exotic animals found in zoos and aquariums. He has worked with close to 50 species of animals, with a focus on marine animals, carnivores, and primates. Eduardo is currently a visiting professor in the School of Behavior Analysis at Florida Institute of Technology. His past positions include an affiliate professorship in the psychology department at University of Washington, research fellowship with Woodland Park Zoo, and National Science Foundation postdoctoral fellowship. Whilst working with UW and Woodland Park Zoo, Eduardo started the Behavioral Enrichment Animal Research Group, otherwise known as BEAR, which conducted welfare research with the African and Asian elephants, hippos, Humboldt penguins, grizzly bears, sun bears, sloth bears, Sumatran tigers, jaguars, African wild dogs, meerkats, golden lion tamarins, and ostriches located at the zoo. Eduardo also continues to run the Animal Reinforcement Forum, otherwise known as ARF, a former listserv and now Facebook group, which is dedicated to group discussions on animal training and behavior from a scientific perspective. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Eduardo to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Eduardo, good morning to you. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good, good. That's a lot of stuff right there. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel the listeners of the show will know some of those acronyms we threw out there, the ORCA and BEAR. And so it's exciting for me to meet the man behind some of these groups.
Yeah, this is exciting. So, good deal.
Hey, Eduardo, let's dive straight into the first question.
Sure.
Can you take the listeners back to where you started your, what we like to call, behavior odyssey?
Yeah.
How did you get started and come to do what you're doing today?
Before I had a passion for creating acronyms, where it all started, I guess, the passion for both animals and acronyms related to animals. So I should stipulate that I am from Philadelphia originally. So no offense to, you know, my Philadelphia people out there, but that's where I grew up. And then my parents, who are from Cuba, they ended up moving us back down to South Florida, or we moved to South Florida, a little closer to where they came from. So in elementary school, and I was saying the Philadelphia thing because I also wanted to say go Eagles. But aside from that, South Florida is where I mainly grew up. I spent a lot of my early childhood, really getting to experience that transition of South Florida becoming a lot more populated, and getting to spend a lot of time watching a lot of animals adapt to all these people coming in and moving further west. I was far closer to the Everglades than what most people might think of as South Florida. And so I spent a lot of my childhood chasing reptiles. Some of those, many of those, not as a little more dangerous than I think most people should let their children chase. So I grew up following alligators and watching them. You know, the snakes and the lizards and the turtles. So I had a very early passion for reptiles and reptile behavior. Those two things were really, I had not known how to really bring those two things together, which was my passion for animals in general, and then just behavior in general, because I would go out and watch these lizards interacting with each other, or watch the alligators adapting to the new homes all around them in the canals that they would be swimming by, and figuring out what to eat or what not to eat. And I would say these are great examples of this far more complex thing that a lot of people do, which is the behavior aspect. So I always thought of them as separate things, which was my interest in behavior and my interest in animals. So while I grew up spending a lot more time looking at animals, then I went off to college and started focusing on studying behavior or psychology in general, and always gravitated to, as a biology kid, as an animal kid, always gravitated to the scientific aspects of the psychological sciences, which aren't always that scientific. Not surprisingly, as an undergraduate at Florida, I found the behavioral faculty, so people like Hank Pennypacker and Tim Hackenberg, that I ended up just taking more and more courses with, and learning as much as I could about this weird philosophy in psychology called behaviorism that really focused on things that I thought of as a kid were just essential, which was observable, measurable aspects, things that I could record, that anyone could record, and function for that behavior as well. That's a big part. You want me to go further into that?
Yeah, keep going. I'm enjoying learning.
Okay. Yeah, so at that time, while there was stuff done in behavior analysis, so I did my undergraduate really focusing on behavior analysis. I was one of the Pennypacker kids doing precision teaching. I was one of his PT managers in my undergraduate, for those that might know about Standard Acceleration Society or using acceleration charts, or this is a different part of behavior analysis that's used often for when we talk about fluency and teaching methods. So that was my early focus in behavior analysis. But I still thought I was going to go off and do more human-oriented stuff, because that's where the majority of psychology and behavior analysis really did things. There was no track for studying animals, working with animals outside of the laboratory. So while I did some laboratory stuff, I just thought I was going to go off and possibly do some autism therapy or organizational behavior management, two fairly established parts of behavior analysis. I actually thought I was going to do clinical psychology, which is one of these things that I figured out pretty early on is, while I love working with people and talking to people and helping people and teaching people, I like it a lot more when there's animals involved. So people in the absence of animals, I found was not as, I wasn't as enthusiastic about that part. I eventually got away from the idea of doing something like clinical psychology and ended up as a master's student at North Texas, thinking I was just going to do more traditional behavior analytic work. So this was the school of it was the Department of Behavior Analysis at North Texas. So I was getting my my MS in behavior analysis, or I had just started. And in that first semester, I had seen that there were some training exercises, part of one course where students would train animals. And there was one student who had just finished or was just finishing her thesis working with horses. And it dawned at me at that moment that this is a field and this is an area where you can actually apply behavioral principles for animals for the purpose of working with animals specifically. The professor who had supervised that thesis, I approached him and said, I want to start an animal lab, an applied animal lab, which that was Jesus Rosales Ruiz. And he just kind of laughed and said, yeah, sure. You know, kind of typical Jesus fashion of saying, oh, okay, sure. I don't think he thought I was that serious. I don't think other people thought I was that serious. And I came back to him a week later. This is in my first semester as a graduate student there. And I came back a week later with a long list of undergraduate and graduate students that would be part of this lab and said, no, I want to start an applied animal behavior lab. And he kind of realized I was serious at that point and said, okay, you know, do what you need to do. You know, I'll be the faculty mentor for it. That's where I started coming up. That I remember specifically sitting in, you know, I spent all the rest of that first semester while taking classes coming up with, what is this lab even going to be? What's it going to be about? Where are we going to work with animals? What's the name of it going to be? Which that was the first challenge. And as somebody who's, enjoyed acronyms or at least the components of the amusing parts of it. That was the first thing. Orcas happened to be one of my favorite animals on the planet. So I thought there's some way I can turn this into an acronym that represents what this lab is about, which I came up with in Cloyd Heighton's OBM course, actually, if I remember specifically. And that's where Organization for Reinforcement Contingencies with Animals came about. So by the spring of my first year of graduate school, we had our first meetings and we were off. And the next 2.5 years got spent. I dedicated as much of my research as I could to ORCA and applied animal behavior and doing all that work.
And so when we caught up last week, and we talk about applied behavior analysis on this podcast a lot, and we talk about defining things a lot.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we've ever really unpacked what that means. But when we were talking last week, you offered a definition of behavior analysis, and I thought there was value in us sharing that today for listeners of the show who, you know, probably out there not thinking as heavily as we might about behavior analysis because they're more practically applying the stuff for their clients. So can we get a little bit geeky on that?
Yeah, we definitely can. You're speaking my language. There's two aspects of, I think, all science that I really, really thoroughly enjoy. And one of those is the aspect of measurement and knowing what you can measure, which this was the big, for me, that was one of the most attractive components of behavior analysis. Because if you're anything like me, when I was studying psychology in high school and in college, I was sitting there taking these courses and saying, yeah, but how do we even know what we're measuring? You know, I would hear these terms and say, but I want to be specific. And the first thing I learned in behavior analysis is everything that we're going to deal with is measurable responses. So we're going to treat everything. And in fact, there was that concept of operational definitions. Before you even go into any measurement system, you need an operational definition, right? So which focuses on the observable, measurable component of any response. So there's that component. And the second component of science, which is not always obvious when you hear me talk, is that I love parsimony. Parsimony really is just the simplest way of being able to explain something. So that said, my simplest operational definition of behavior analysis is what I've said is, well, there's the two components. There's behavior and analysis. And the behavior means this is something that's observable and measurable. That's what we focus on. That's tied into the analysis, which the analysis means data taking. So we're going to measure. So we're talking about observable, measurable behavior that we're going to, in fact, measure. And we're going to use data to assess function. So, that's my basic definition of behavior analysis.
So you were just sitting in those classes saying, yeah, but I want to be specific. And asking that question, how do we know what we're even measuring? And since then, as you've been engaging with people that work practically with animal training, as opposed to people who are in a lab.
Right.
Do you think that... How can we apply this question that you were asking yourself, but how do we even know what we're measuring? Do you see animal trainers asking that question, or do you only see researchers in your university groups asking that question, or both, or neither?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I think animal training has had a long history, and I say this too because I had interests early on in the biological study of animal behavior, or animal behavior as studied by biologists, which has often been ethologists. In my doctorate, I spent a lot of time taking courses with behavioral ecologists and over in biology, and then working with Bill Timberlake and looking at ethological as well as psychological or behavior analytic aspects of behavior. And I think something that people don't realize is how much they have in common about using observable responses to understand function. That there's been a long history for animal trainers to be to focus on observable behavior. Those are the aspects that we want to change, right? So animal trainers have had that luxury, I think, of knowing, rather than say many psychologists doing any form of applied work where they may not have that focus directly on observable responding. Animal trainers are right there. We've all, I'm including myself here, have always looked at observable behavior. Where we go from there can get a little different. So the question then is, to what extent are we willing to measure the things that we observe as animal trainers? And the obvious answer is usually, I'm busy training the animal, so I may not have the time or the ability or the manpower or resources or whatever it is to bring in measurement. So I'm at least going to focus on things that I can define and observe directly, and that's what I'm going to focus on changing. But I think the second component, if we want to be behavior analytic as animal trainers, is to bring in the measurement in some way.
And we're going to, before I phrase what we're going to talk about as getting geeky, we are going to get geeky on this. I want to go back a little bit before we do that and go down a rabbit hole because it presented itself and it was very appealing to me. You've got your academic qualifications in behavior analyst. You've also got minors in neuroscience and animal behavior from an ethological perspective.
Yeah.
So my question is, We at Animal Training Academy, we're heavily focused on applied behavior analysis. And to quote Dr. Susan Friedman, we keep our sister sciences nice and close. And I always kind of am looking for ways to articulate, you know, how we look at behavior, having all of those different lenses available to us. And when we maybe, I'm going to use a metaphor here, so go with me, when we maybe take one hat off and put the other hat on, or are you wearing multiple hats at the same time?
I guess I tend to be wearing I try to wear multiple hats at the same time, because behavior, like all of science, doesn't occur in a vacuum. So we have to be willing to understand all these things. You know, this is something Bob Bailey has talked about in the past, about Pavlov always being on your shoulder. And I've done my own little breaking down of what that ultimately means. But I guess one thing I should say to start off with, and this is something, because I think many people learn about the psychological approach to animal behavior, which we often think of as behavior analysis, but more generally has been comparative psychology. And we could get really geeky about talking about the levels of distinction there, but I'm going to leave that for the sake of parsimony here. I'm going to leave that, just talk about, we can talk about behaviorism. So the behavioral or behaviorism approach to animal behavior, or behavior in general, and then people often pitted that against the biological or ethological approach. And certainly the ethologists and the behaviorists have had some obvious distinctions between the two of them, and times that they have butted heads about particular topics. So the ethologists, if we're talking about historically, you know, they came from Europe, they were biologists, and they were often interested in things that the animal came to the table with, whereas the behaviorists tended to be American. They tended to be psychologists, and they were often interested in the things the animals learned. So it's that last part. So the learning versus what the animal's coming to the table with, that I think people have accurately identified as, well, to what extent is this ethological versus behavioral or behavior analytic in its approach. But those two things, they should go well together. And I think most people recognize that. So you have to understand what the animal is coming to the table with to better understand how it learns. I've often said that the argument of, some people would call this the nature versus nurture debate, et cetera, et cetera. And I find a lot of those arguments to be not exactly that useful. It's kind of like trying to argue what makes a race car go fast, the body or the engine. Well, the answer is it needs both, right? So if you just have the frame of the race car out there, it's not going to go anywhere. And if you just have the engine out there, it's not going to go anywhere. So both are required. So these things don't occur in a vacuum, right? So that said, I talk about, when I'm trying to put on these multiple hats, when I'm looking at how animal behavior works, I remember this, I always come back to this idea of Pavlov always being on your shoulder and what that means. And when you look at respondent or Pavlovian conditioning, so the first real academic foray into understanding learning from a behavioral perspective, you have that stimulus-stimulus pairing, right? So a neutral stimulus that becomes a conditioned or a conditional stimulus paired with an unconditioned or an unconditional stimulus. So this is the traditional, the bell with food paired with food example. And which, by the way, was not Bell a Bell or food. Just thought I'd mention that. So it was actually it was a tone or the with meat powder. But we'll go past that. The tone of the chime there, but the unconditioned stimulus in that is all about the things the animal is coming to the table with. So what you're doing is in Pavlovian conditioning is you're conditioning a response that the animal is there, comes to the table with to begin with. So to understand that first component, we need to understand the organism itself. And that's part of why I think when you think of Pavlov always being on your shoulder, it means you have to consider not just the behaviors, not just the animal that's learning, or I should say, not just the learning that's happening, but also the animal that is doing the learning. So, yeah.
And how does your neuroscience hit? Because I'm going from what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, and running with our metaphor, which actually I got from Dr. Carolina Westlund from the University of Stockholm, of wearing different hats. And
sure,
we play around with this idea of taking one hat, putting the other hat on, and kind of looking at behavior through different lenses. But you're wearing them all. So you've got your engine and your body and your ecologist hat and your behavior analysis hat on, and on top of that you've got your neuroscience hat. Is that the lens you're looking through?
A little bit. And I don't want to offend anybody with, so my neuroscience is really rusty these days, I should say, so there's not anything that I'm doing that involves neuroscience these days. I look at a lot of neuroscience as really kind of getting at helping bridge some of that gap between what the organism is able to learn and how the organism is able to learn. The neuroscience component helps bridge some of that gap between knowing about what can be learned and what the organism is able to learn and why it's able to learn. So I should point out, so let me give an example here. Although, again, the simple answer to what you were asking is I do nothing with neuroscience these days. So, but one of the things Skinner talked about early on was he talked about what makes a reinforcer reinforcing, which is a question that he would get, a question that he would address. And he had a simple answer to that, which he talks about in books like About Behaviorism. And he says, you know, what I have available and what all behaviorists, all behavior analysts have available to them is the fact of whether a response is reinforced. The concept of what makes a reinforcer reinforcing is an interesting question, but that is for the what he would describe as the anatomist or physiologist of the future to identify. He said it's not an immediate question for behavior analysis. What he can do, what he can manipulate and look at and examine descriptively is how reinforcement works in terms of changing the behavior, you know, what is being reinforced, the response that's being reinforced and increased or other components. So identifying that function. And a lot of neuroscience has looked to answer. So that's, I think if Skinner would have gone back to the 70s or 80s, if he could now, he would change that answer from the anatomist or physiologist to the neuroscientist. So those are the kind of things that I think a lot of neuroscience answers is, hey, you know what? What makes a reinforcer reinforcing? And then beyond that, you have people in fields like neuroethology that are saying, oh, and also why, so what is it about the organism's evolutionary history that helps bring that about? But these are also, I am not the person well-suited to help answer those questions. So I am, while many describe me as an applied ethologist on top of being a behavior analyst, I am not a neuroscientist, nor would I ever claim to be.
Well, let's go then to the thing that you are really excited about bringing to the table in this podcast episode. You described behavior analysis as behavior, something that is observable and measurable, and the analysis part as data taking. which you're, and maybe this has come across already in the podcast, very passionate about this subject. And can you talk about this for us, how we use data collection in our training, in our animal training specifically? And you said you had three basic tools that you can share with us that people can use.
Yeah. So if anyone's fallen asleep hearing me talk about all these more academic components, this is the pragmatic part. This is the most important for looking at bringing behavior analysis to animals, which now we're getting into the data taking. Let's talk about that. So data itself is, it is a requirement of bringing behavior analysis, right? This is the only way that I know of to be able to accurately identify the function of behavior, is you have to bring measurement. And that's ultimately our goal, right? Animal trainers, applied animal behaviors in general, when we look at behavior, we want to identify the function of that behavior to be able to effectively change it. That's using data. Now, behavior analysts have specific ways that they talk about identifying function. And one of those tools is, you know, functional analysis, which is a specific methodology. It is not the only tool for identifying the function of behavior, nor is it necessarily that useful. So I'm not going to talk about functional analyses as that specific AWADA procedure, but I am going to talk about identifying functions of behavior. And that's done through data, right? So this is all part of what we're talking about when we talk about the ABCs, the antecedent behavior consequence of behavior. And then using data in some way to help improve on our understanding of the function of that response. And that includes understanding, to some extent, species-typical behavior. But here we're really talking about what the animals have learned, what they are learning, what they continue to learn, what they have learned. All of that said, you need to use some type of so we focus on operational definitions, things that we can measure directly, and then measurement systems of some sort, how we measure that behavior. And the most simple one that I talk about is using a preference assessment of some sort. So all of this is to say, part of the reason why we want to use data is because we're not that great at remembering things. And all of us, myself included, have all kinds of weird beliefs, right, that we come to the table with. So we may not be that good at assessing. So let me give you an example. So you may look at what you're going to do with your dog. Say you want to start shaping some type of behavior. And you say, oh, yeah, we just got to grab these treats. Well, because this is the dog's preferred treat, and this is what's going to work most effectively as a reinforcer. So let's just go with that. So now we're talking about, this is an anecdotal belief. Yep, this is the preferred item. Okay, but is it always the preferred item? And how well do you know that that's a preferred item? Is it going to be the most effective reinforcer in that shaping program? And it turns out when we look at some of the data, I'm happy to give anybody more specific references, but so applied behavior analysts, when they started looking at doing preference assessments for the fact of determining reinforcers, they also looked at, so they were doing this in classroom settings with teachers, and then they would specifically ask the teachers, hey, which candy do you think Johnny over there is going to pick as his favorite candy? So they would do things like that, you know, and the teachers would say, well, you know, I've been working with him for the past 6 months, it's going to be Snickers. And it turned out, based on these studies, that the kids weren't, the teachers didn't line up all that great with what the kids were picking. There's been a little bit of stuff done with this and for applied animal purposes as well. And preferences are, of course, not static. They change based on condition, based on when you're testing, things like satiation. But all of that is to say, we can't assume that we know what's going to be the most effective reinforcer. We shouldn't. So we should come to that place of saying, hey, you know what? Maybe this is a belief I have that's just anecdotal, and I can in some way use measurement to help better assess that. So it's that simple. What I end up showing people is there's a type of preference assessment called a paired choice preference assessment. And I'll give you the most basic breakdown here, which is just imagine you have six possible items you could use as a reinforcer. Okay, well, then let's compare all trials of that. So let's take the Snickers and the Milky Way for the candy items, and let's put them in those paired choices and just give the person that, you know, or the animal, the dog or the polar bear that you want to test preferences for. I worked with polar bears for many years, so I always like using them as examples. So you give them the choice of those two options, and you mark which one of those two choices they make. You balance that. So you counterbalance that for position as well, left and right. So, and you measure every possible choice, and that helps determine, after you get done with all those trials, you've now identified what's being selected most and what's being selected least. So in this case, if we were talking about six items, that's 30 total trials of, you know, left, all left, right side, and all possible choices. So, it's that simple. When you're used to doing things like preference assessments, you can do that in a matter of minutes. I know 30 trials may sound like a lot. I have a simple data sheet for looking at. My simple data sheet is with four items. For doing four items, and I'm happy to share that with anybody, so I can send you that. I think I already did send you. Yes, perfect. It's that simple.
So the preference assessment of some sort, and you talked about the peer choice preference assessment then. Did I get that name correct?
Yeah.
And so the three basic tools are go through those. What name them for me. I'm struggling to pull them out specifically from what you just said. All of that was extremely valuable. I've written down notes here, but I'd rather hear it from you.
So this is just the first example of a way to start bringing in data to help with any animal, for any applied animal purpose, but specifically animal training. So I talk about the use of these preference assessments also for doing things like identifying enrichment. Since I've done a lot of research and work with enrichment, and I've used these preference assessments to help identify enrichment as well. So I've done environmental enrichment. I've done a lot of work in zoos looking at aspects of that, since that's a big part of what's done to improve the welfare of animals in zoological settings. But, you know, we talk about that now a lot for dogs and cats and all pets, is the importance of enrichment itself. I just even the act of identifying enrichment. So the need to identify, okay, well, what's going to work best? So let me take a step back real quick here. I identify enrichment as a contingency. So the same way I identify reinforcement as a contingency. So this should be at the heart of all definitions of enrichment. So enrichment is not a thing. It's not just a thing. It's a contingency. So that said, what that means is, just like I wouldn't say, oh, you know, I used reinforcement, but it didn't work. That's not possible, right? By definition, that's not possible. Because reinforcement is a contingency, which includes, so that contingency, whether we want to, we'll focus just on the three-term contingency, needs a demonstration of an increase in behavior following some consequence for the definition of reinforcement, right? So you can't use reinforcement, but it didn't work, because by definition, there has to be that increase in behavior. And likewise, enrichment is not just a thing. So enrichment is that contingency, meaning you have to see an increase in some for lack of a better word, I'll say a desirable response, but what we would hope is something naturalistic. So an increase in some positive welfare measure to identify that the animal had in fact been enriched. So what I say is it's not enrichment unless it enriches, just like it's not reinforcement unless it reinforces. So you have to demonstrate that relationship. Enrichment is not just throwing in a bunch of items. It's demonstrating that interaction with the item that increases X, Y, or Z for those behaviors for that animal. So that said, you can use preference assessments to help identify enrichment items that are more likely to enrich, or I should say, since we're identifying enrichment by this contingency, to identify items that are more likely to be enrichment. So, yeah. So that's the first, that's just one of the simplest tools. And it's the first component. I like talking about paired choice preference assessments because it's one of the easiest tools and it helps people recognize one, that data collection is amazing and useful for all things behavior wise, it's not just for the laboratory, it's important in applied settings. And then the second component is, it can be easy, but that brings its own set of questions to bear, which is, okay, but now I have to tackle all these pragmatic components about how do I do this and what happens when I'm, you know, I did this one time and it ended up, I got different results when I did it another time. All of these are a whole new set of questions. So I look at preference assessments as the first approximation that I like shaping up in data collecting animal training, trainer behavior.
So then does that lead us to the next approximation?
Yeah. So there's a lot of things that people can do to start incorporating data. The next component, so now if everyone has some experience with doing preference assessments, which can be done multiple times a day at different times, where I like to go from there is to start talking about, okay, now how about the actual training procedures you're involved in? So the shaping procedures you're involved in. So shaping often gets described as an art, more so than a science. And this is often the case in behavior analysis as well. Right. So we talk about, that's something that, you know, shaping specific definition of using approximations that are differentially reinforced to some target response. These things are, we have a great operational definition. We know how to engage in shaping as Skinner and others have outlined. But when it comes to measuring shaping, well, I just do it, right? That's often the answer is, you know, in the laboratory as well. So it's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, we have simple behaviors that we're often looking at in the laboratory when we're talking about looking at operant behavior. So we have key pecs for pigeons or lever pressing for rats. Sometimes require very little to no shaping. So you may use some other procedures just to get that response. Again, that's a whole other topic altogether. It does require shaping and even in the laboratory, laboratory scientists that are doing operant research are familiar. They know shaping. They know what they need to do, but there's not much in terms of the measurement of that shaping process. So what I talk about, so animal trainers are not alone in this using or lack of using data to examine shaping. Everyone is virtually dataless in shaping. So what I've talked about, and this was starting with my master's thesis at North Texas and going on from there and bringing this to some zoo environments that I've worked in and with other dog trainers is, hey, how can we start to measure our progress that we're doing? Well, the accomplishments we're getting in our shaping programs. And again, so I have a simple data sheet, and I have some simple PowerPoint. I may not have already given you that, but I'm happy to share. I should break down parts of a PowerPoint that shows how this can be done. Which is the first thing I talk about is discrete trials. So setting up discrete trials, which just means a defined start and finish to each thing, every behavior you're going to measure when you start the trial and the end of the trial, which most trainers are already doing, right? Particularly if we're adding a cue or requiring a response to a cue, but even just approaching the animal and looking for, hey, this is what I'm going to, my first approximation that I'm going to shape. So allow the animal to engage in that response. If it doesn't engage, maybe you take a step back or you start a new trial. All of these things end up being discrete trials. And therefore, we have a measurable, so hopefully we have a basic operational definition of the response we want, and then a measurable amount of time the response can occur in for that discrete trial. And we can set this up in 5 to 10 trials for each approximation. Now, I should say this does a couple things. It allows you to start measuring your success, which is really important, right? Because again, going back to this idea that we all believe weird things, we all rely on anecdote. We have generally, all of us have not great memories. So we all over and under assess, depending on what bias we're leaning towards, how good or bad things are going. And the more anecdotal data that we collect rather than actual quantitative data, the worse we tend to get with that. And what I mean by that is, look, he's doing really well. I'm shaping up, you know, I was working on this behavior with my dog. I'm shaping this up. He's been doing really well. He's doing great. And somebody else comes in and steps in and says, yeah, he's not learning any of that. Like I'm seeing a very big difference. And this can create these arguments where people say, oh, no. See, this is working better than that. No, well, I think this is working better than that. And it's all based on anecdote and belief. So once we start bringing in the measurement, now this is part of why I say data ends arguments. So if I hear two trainers saying, no, well, you need to do this. Or to keepers, or to anyone dealing with applied animal behavior in any aspect, saying, no, we need to, the dog's only learning with this trainer. No, he's learning with all trainers, but he's not learning under this condition. No, you're moving too fast. Yeah, I think you're moving too slow. Any of these type of arguments that you'll often hear trainers other people working with animal behavior in one sort or another dealing with, they can be answered specifically with collecting data. So that's, and I've covered all three of my bases now in a roundabout way of talking about why we need to collect data as applied animal people. But this next, so the other component of collecting, of using shaping data, using data to help guide your training program, is it forces you to come up with a shaping plan and to come up with identifying specifically coming up with operational definitions for your approximations and your target response. Because I know I've done this. I've watched others do this. Sometimes we go into, hey, I'm just going to start training behavior. And you might even stop yourself or another person and say, what are you training towards? And the person says, I don't know. I'm starting to click and treat, right? So I'm looking and I'm deciding these things on the fly. Well, shaping plans are particularly helpful in helping avoid that level of confusion, I think. And that's not to, I should say, sometimes that's great. Just training on the fly, right? It has extremely useful components, but at some point, all of us should be interested in bringing in data at some level.
So going back to what you said, I just want to unpack this a little bit more. We have a measurable basic operational definition of what we're trying to train.
Yep.
We have a measurable, and I think you said we have a measurable amount of time.
Yes.
And then you said we can set this up as trials for each approximation. So can you explain a little bit more what you mean by that?
Yeah. So let me give an example, and this is something from a bit further back. So I was working with an African crested porcupine. So I want to put this in a way that makes it a little easier to understand for just at least put it in a proper context for the listener. One of the early orca projects was working with this African crested porcupine. His name was Hatari, which I don't know how many people speak Swahili that will be listening. But Swahili, in Swahili, that means danger. And if you're wondering about African crested porcupines, like I think many for any North American listeners, they're saying, oh, yeah, you know, it's this nice little guy. Now, African crested porcupines are about 3-4 times the size of our North American porcupines. They're about the size of a medium dog. Right. So they're 2+ feet in length or so. I don't know how long they can get. They're big. They're not tiny. Our North American porcupines are tiny. The New World porcupines are much smaller. And unlike the North American guys, they don't have barbed quills. They just have these large stabby spikes on the ends of their quills. And they have these really long, flexible quills that can get several, they can raise them to several feet high. And then these shorter, very non-flexible, very stabby quills, as I like to point out. And these guys have been known in the wild to be able to fend off and potentially kill lions trying to eat them. So these are, they're, while every African crested porcupine I've ever met has been extremely sociable and great to be around, they're dangerous, right? They can be dangerous, particularly if you're a lion, I guess. So we were working with one who was really friendly. I mean, more friendly than most other African crested porcupines that I've met. And they're all, like, as I've said, I may be a bit biased here. Most of the porcupines I've met have been used to being around people. They've all been extremely friendly. So there may be bias on my part, but this one was super excited to see people. Think like this was like the Jack Russell Terrier of African crested porcupines. You would show up to his enclosure and he'd want to just come rush out towards you. He didn't come out of his enclosure at that time, not in working with us. Another amazing thing about him is that he did not seem to engage in any level of satiation. I still to this day have never seen anything like this. So this might make him a little bit more like the Labrador of African crested porcupines, right? Just anything you put in front of him, he would eat, and you would be on like the fifth or sixth part of an apple and of a whole apple, and he'd still be eating that bit of an apple because we were cutting up our apples into pieces. He would still be eating that last one like he had never seen an apple before. Like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing ever. Thank you. Thank you. And he'd be eating that. So all of this is to say, we wanted to more effectively be able to have people go into his enclosure and be able to do things like clean out the enclosure, change his bedding, his food, his water, without this fairly large porcupine jumping on them and with all these really large stabby quills. That's a little dangerous. So what we decided was we're gonna shape the target response was we want to shape him to or we want to get him to hold to a target for 30+ seconds. And that way, what we did was we put a Kong, that was his target, on the end of a chain, and we could put it at the back of the enclosure and just stick it on the enclosure. He would have to go over, hold to the target. We could go into the enclosure, clean it out, and then walk out of the enclosure, click and treat, and he'd run over and grab the treat after holding to that Kong. So we came up with, I think it was 10 or so approximations. And by the way, I have all this graphed, all this data graphed. I have this written up. So it's a paper that I'll be submitting. It's an older paper, but I'll be sending this back out for review soon. and I'm happy to share this with any listeners. So we came up with all these approximations, which started with the first approximation just being, I think, approaching the target and touching the target, and then working up through how many seconds they would hold to the target. And the way we would start a trial is we would present the target. And then, so that's the start of a trial. Give him, I think it was about 2 to 3 seconds to do something in response to the target being presented. And then he would either contact it or he might try to chew on it, which, by the way, we looked at chewing as trial terminating response. It was an undesired response. So if he actually chewed on the target, we would remove the target. That would end the trial. He wouldn't be rewarded for that. And then we'd start a new trial. But that was it right there. That was the start of the trial. We presented the target and he had several seconds to respond. And then we would pull the target. And we would run that in 10 trials. And we would simply mark whether he engaged or didn't engage in the response. Now, we also measured all the other behaviors that he would engage in, including whether he held to it for longer after we clicked and treated. But that aside, this is as simple as it gets for starting to measure shaping, is come up with the defined response. And then, so you have your operational definition for all the approximations and your target response. You start coming up with your plan for all of the approximations, and then decide how you're going to start each trial. Okay, what starts a trial and ends a trial? Is it, you know, the dog approaches you, or I was just assuming dog there. I was talking about porcupines. So, and we should talk more about cat behavior too, because I know Ryan and I have both spent a lot of time previously talking about cats and cat behavior. We're both cat enthusiasts. Yeah, you're looking at a definable response and a definable start and finish to each trial. And now that's it. You have the interval that you can measure within and the thing that you're measuring. And the simple measurement is just whether it occurred or didn't occur. So a plus or minus. I think this helps make a little more sense when you see the data sheets that we use to measure this, as well as all of the approximations some of those examples. So, yeah, I'm happy to share all of that.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. I'm glad I asked that question. So we have I made a note of it somewhere, the preferential choice. Paired, what was it? Sorry.
Paired choice preference assessment.
No, paired choice preference assessment.
You're doing great with these names, by the way. I feel like I haven't rewarded you enough for, I'm really actually kind of amazed that your retention for all these very specific terms is pretty amazing.
Well, it actually brings up one of the reasons why we need to collect data and take data, because we're not, as you said, we're not great at remembering things. So I might make a lot of notes while you're talking, and the thing is I deleted that specific title, so I couldn't actually remember it.
See,
my data was gone.
I was thinking you were defeating my entire point to saying, like, I was like, I'm sitting here talking about how we're not great at remembering things, and I'm like, and Ryan's defeating this because he's remembering everything I'm saying, and then you end up proving my point by saying you're writing these things down. So that's great.
So, I mean, and so the other reasons why we want to collect data is we have weird beliefs that come to the table that aren't necessarily based on data.
Right.
So you came up with this weird belief that I was actually good at remembering things, but you didn't have the data that I was actually taking notes.
Right. I just assumed you were I had a weird anecdotal based belief that you were smarter than apparently you are, Ryan. So but now, see, that's another weird belief too, is I'm assuming good memory equals smart. See, all these weird beliefs were unraveling.
What does smart look like?
Right.
And okay, so we've got the tiered choice preference testing, we've got the data collection from shaping when shaping behavior, and you've given a great example as to how that actually looks. What does that look like? So we started off thinking about three tools.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that's two.
That is two.
Is there another one?
That is two. There is a third one.
So, yes, please dive in.
Yeah. Okay, so uh, I And I apologize to, at least to some extent about this. I know we talked about passion talk and but I am wordy. And I think the listeners have figured this out by now. I will talk and talk and talk. So often it's a little easier when I'm presenting to be able to identify when I'm over talking, and I've gotten better at that as I've gotten older. So I apologize if I'm putting anybody to sleep with so much detail, but I am wordy. So I'm going to try to make this less wordy, this third tool, so that for people who are enjoying this, listening to this, let's talk a little, let's get a little more parsimonious going back to that. So the third tool that I say is, how do we measure everything? So now everything, you want to be able to know things like all the things that that this animal you're interested in working with, what are they doing throughout the day? What are they doing? You know, hey, you start working with a new client and the client says, my dog barks all the time. I want you to come in and stop my dog from barking, right? So that does probably sound at least a little familiar. I'm using some facetious examples here and obviously it's oversimplifying it. But my dog barks all the time. And you might say, okay, well, how much is your dog barking? All the time. Okay. When is your dog barking? All the time. Okay. Where is your dog barking? Everywhere. Okay. So maybe the first part is knowing to what extent, you know, how much is the dog barking? Under what conditions is the dog barking? So now here we have some basic questions. So when I'm working in zoo environments, I may be, the question at hand may be, are polar bears, going back to polar bears. I love polar bears, one of the most terrifying animals on the planet. And therefore, my 10-year-old self also thinks equally amazing. I have a weird correlation there with how terrifying an animal is and therefore how much I want to work with it. So I spent 5+ years working with polar bears. But you may encounter an exhibit that the polar bears, you know, the keepers or the management may say, well, you know, they're not as active as we would like. Okay, well, when are they inactive? When are they less active? Or they're spending a lot of time pacing. Okay, well, let's look at when that pacing occurs or the inactivity. When does that change? What does it look like throughout the day? So there's a simple tool called an ethogram. Often other names are behavioral assays or behavioral inventories. And the simple point of this is that you can come up with all the possible things that an animal can be engaging in. And then you can start to measure that. You come up with a measurement system. So this is the advanced level of bringing data in for applied animal purposes, is now we've got to come up with all these operational definitions for all these different things that the animal can engage in. We got to come up with a measurement system, which means choosing that measurement system. How long are our recording intervals? But all of these things can be made extremely simple. So we can say, I just 6 times a day, I just want to know, you know, here's 5 different responses that we're interested in measuring. And I want the owner to mark down 6 times a day what the animal is doing. So what was your dog doing? You know, you walk by, it's in the morning, write down the time. Was your dog, you know, sleeping, barking, running around, or out of sight? You know, here's 4 or 5 different things that your dog could be doing. Just check each one of those and write down the time of day and do that as many times. You know, if you can do that, you know, 3 times a day, 6 times a day, great. That's a simple recording. That's now you're talking about quantitative data, right? So you're getting away from just a description. So what I would call the field notes component, the anecdotal notes, and you're moving it towards, hey, now I've got a quantitative measure. And it can be that simple. It can be a lot more complex. I've had ethograms that are as many as 24, 25 behaviors, being measured every 15 seconds for, you know, hours at a time, for multiple animals, in some cases, multiple species. So this can get very complex. I have resources that are great for people to use. But the key thing, this addresses all of my favorite topics about data, because it lets me focus on these last components of the importance of data taking. And this last component is any data is better than no data. So, and I should be specific here, any quantitative data is better than no quantitative data. I emphasize that anecdote is a great starting place, and I don't want to take away from people using notes, which are really, when we're talking about writing notes or what I call field notes, that's a great starting place. But that is not the same as quantitative data. That is still data, right? So this is what scientists would call qualitative data. And when I talk about data, I'm really emphasizing quantitative data because I want something that can be measured and then therefore be used as a comparison. And that's really that last part. And any quantitative data is better than no quantitative data. So at whatever level you can start to incorporate some measure in some way, I encourage all applied animal behavior people to do that. Just bring in, you know, whatever is the start of that, bring in some level of data. And it may be this last tool is the easiest and most useful for somebody to use to say, hey, you know what? Rather than just telling the owner in this situation, because I'm assuming, again, we're talking about a dog consult here or a cat consult, and you want to try to, you know, the owner of this pet has asked you to come in. They want you to intervene on this, and they say this is happening all the time. Well, the first step maybe, can we get a better idea of what all the time is? What does that mean? Yeah, so it's that simple.
I love ending it on that. That simple, everyone.
It's that simple, right? None of the above may have sounded simple at all. But this is all an ongoing process. This is a shaping project for everyone. Hopefully for all the listeners, this is a shaping project. Meaning you start where you can. If this is a basic approximation of where to start, is meaning, hey, you know what? Let me find one thing that I can start quantitatively measuring. Then it is that simple.
That was amazing. We're going to move on to our last question, but just before we do, remember everyone, data collection is amazing and useful and easy. Everyone is virtually data-less in shaping. And why do all of this? Because data ends arguments. Hey, let's go on to our final question for this episode, Eduardo. We started off with where your behavior odyssey got going. I'd like to ask you now to share with the listeners of this show your vision for the future. What do you really want to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the data collection, behavior analyst, animal training world?
Yeah. Well, this should probably come as no surprise, based on all I've been talking about. But I want to see more data being collected by animal trainers. I want to start seeing us move into this quantitative world. And again, I just want to be clear, I use qualitative data as well. I use, but I think the end all be all when we're really talking about data is quantitative measures. So I want to see animal trainers move in this direction. Anyone doing anything with applied animal behavior, all applied animal behaviors moving in the direction of bringing in as much data as they possibly can. So I think that's where the field is going, should go. I know I've spent early in my career and now later in my career, I've spent a lot of time talking about the use of data for applied purposes. And we have a great example of that, which is already in applied behavior analysis. When we talk about what applied behavior analysis has done and is doing, at its core is the incorporation of quantitative measures. That is a requirement. If you went into any applied human setting, where most applied behavior analysts are, you would see, and you see board certified behavior analysts, all of, you know, part of what with Florida Tech I work on with students that are working towards becoming BCBAs. So I work with graduate students there and I supervise projects. You would see these BCBAs, BCABAs, all these behavior analysts that are using data in every possible way, quantitative data, to implement interventions and measure their success. So when I hear animal trainers saying this doesn't work, I could never bring this in, you know, my client pays for my time, I can't bring this into a client, et cetera, I say, look, again, let's start with the most basic. Where's the simplest way you can bring this in? And we have a great example of how this has been done to the fullest extent, which is every other field of applied behavior analysis. So it is possible. So that's where I hope I want to see all of applied animal behavior move in the direction of becoming more quantitative in their approach to, improving the lives of the animals they work with, because that's the end all be all. This is not, so I guess I should end on that. Data is not there just to be scientific, right? Like we're not just, I just wanted some data because I find this interesting. I do. I love data. I find it absolutely interesting. But the entire purpose here of what we're talking about in terms of data is for the purpose it's applied and for the purpose of improving the lives of the animals you work with. That is the point. So you're going to better be able to evaluate both the failures and successes you have if you're bringing in data.
Well, no one can argue with that, and that's why we're here. So it's been what's the correct word? Perspective shifting episode for me to build on my knowledge and to contemplate my application of this and the next approximations that would be beneficial for me to take so that we can improve the lives of animals. So this has been a ton of fun, Eduardo. Before we finish up, do you want to just let everyone know listening where they can go to get in touch with you to find out more information?
Yeah. So I should say I have a workshop in the fall all about this that I'm so I'm doing a workshop in Frankfurt, Germany. I'll share that link with you as well. That's all about using data collection, using data. And how to do that. I just gave a seminar a couple weekends ago, or I just gave a couple talks at the Pet Professional Guild seminar exactly this topic. One of the easiest ways to get a hold of me is often through Facebook. So you can feel free to shoot me a message on Facebook, send me a friend request. So I have the Behavioral Enrichment Animal Research Group is both a page and a group on Facebook. So that's BEAR, Behavioral Enrichment Animal Research group. There's both a page and an actual group. The Animal Reinforcement Forum is its own group on Facebook as well, ARF. Again, back to my love of acronyms. We have a few trainers in the Seattle area, since I'm based in Seattle, Washington. Peter Amelia and I started a group about a year ago, which the name of it is AVES, so like the birds, AVES. And that's one of the ones that I did not. So Peter and I were throwing around all different fun acronym type things. And it was actually one of the other people in the group that came up with the words of the acronym, which stands for Animal Ventures in Established Science. So that was Ada, who's a member of that group, came up with that. But there's a few. I know you work with Carrie Kish, and Peter and Carrie work closely together with Reptelligence. So back to reptiles, too. I love coming all the way back around on topics. You're more than welcome to check out the AVs group, which we normally meet about once a month out in the Seattle area at Peter and Dana's place out in Issaquah. We train goats and parrots, and we bring in data for measuring our training successes when we can, and just working on getting better at collecting data while training. Peter and I more recently have been talking about doing some online meetings. So that will hopefully be a thing too. So people are more than welcome to message me and request joining that group there. And I'll send you the link to the workshop that'll be in German. And then I'm doing a couple webinars as well. Another one for Pet Professional Guild, PPG, in September. So, and you can always shoot me an email. So,
boom. Well, we'll link to all of that in the show notes, so you as a listener can find that all in one place at animaltrainingacademy.com on the write-up for this podcast episode. Hey, Eduardo, this has been so much fun. From myself and on behalf of everyone listening and all of the animals that are going to benefit from data collection, we really appreciate you taking time to come on the show today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this has been amazing. Thank you. And everybody who's stayed tuned all the way through, you're awesome. So thank you.
You are awesome. We really appreciate you as well. Thank you for tuning in today. If you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnish, choice-rich ways, what does that look like? Let's collect some data and operationalize that. Yeah. And then, as mentioned at the start of the episode, the ATA community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com, click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as a social media Netflix platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone. We're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We'll wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.